Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Stephen Crowley began his career taking pictures for a small newspaper in Florida. From the early 90s to 2017, he worked at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. In 2002, he was cited as Photographer of the Year by the White House News Photographers Association. Tonight at 6:30 local time at Mercury Gardens in Brookings, he has a presentation where he will discuss photojournalism, journalism, and media in changing times. Stephen Crowley joins us from the Janine Basinger Studio on the SDSU campus. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori Walsh. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm excited to talk to you. How are you doing? Welcome to South Dakota.
Excited to talk to you, but remember, I'm a photographer, and I mumble.
All right. We'll allow it. Tell me first, how long has the New York Times had White House coverage? What's the history behind that during your career?
They've covered the White House since, whether they bought the paper over 100 years ago. They staffed their first photographer was a man named George Thames. That was during the Roosevelt administration. And they've only had 8 staff photographers based in the Washington Bureau since then.
And how did you end up there? Because
that's
a long story.
I'll abbreviate. I worked at the Palm Beach Post in Florida along with my 2 brothers. And then the Miami Herald for 2 years, moved up to Washington because I loved politics and I really wanted to get closer to it. And I went to the Washington Times. And in 1992, there was an opening for a lab tech in the Bureau. And I had been turned down by everybody multiple times, AP 9 times, all the magazines, because my shooting was a little odd. And I'm putting that in air quotes. So I went for this lab tech job, and it was 25 hours a week. And they hired me, and I was 39 years old. I was starting at the bottom again, but I thought if I could get 1 or 2 shooting assignments a week, it'd be wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And that turned into a staff job within a year, and 25 years later, here I am.
Did it take some time for the rest of the world to sort of catch up with the style that you were doing? Let's talk about that word odd in quotations. You've been called idiosyncratic and artistic. And, so tell me a little bit about your style and how suddenly that became something that the world needed.
Well, I'm not sure the world needs it, and only probably half of the reading public appreciates it. But then that's my goal. If half of the people understand my work, great, and if the other half at least appreciate the effort, then I'm fine. But I photography changed, technology changed, and the New York Times changed. And I had a wonderful, the woman who hired me, Nancy Lee, she came out of an art school, so she saw somebody a little different as a possible asset. And I worked hard for them, and I gave them what they needed, and I used to offer up the daily challenge, and sometimes they'd run it, and sometimes they wouldn't. And I always tried to stay ahead of, I started shooting videos in 2006 and did that for about a year and a half and developed little zines and the like. Yeah. So,
what's the daily challenge?
Oh, that would be something that, okay, this isn't exactly from the center of the velvet rope looking at the lectern, but it's, I always tried to poke through the edges of every event because every politician. And it started with Ronald Reagan's administration where they tried to create the photo of the day, right? And they wanted you to, this is the picture they wanted to see on national television, on the front page of every newspaper. So I always tried to avoid being manipulated or try to find a little bit of stagecraft behind it and add a little layer or two to every event.
Right. I want to talk more about that. I want to get to more of that and have you expand on it. Because did it come from a sense of, hey, this is boring? Did it come from a sense of sort of independent journalistic thinking? Was it, I have an artistic eye and I see something better? Dig down to what you were thinking in that thought, in that process.
It was never boring. Politics is never boring. Obviously an important beat. And
no, I mean like the shot itself that they were presenting you could be a boring shot. Yeah.
I wanted to dig down past, the messaging if I could, if it was there. So Am I being evasive enough?
No, but, we have so many, people running for office on the show, and just from a radio standpoint, I know how hard it is to get past in just a conversation, those talking points, what that messaging is going to be. And so it's a selfish question, really, and sort of saying, how do you do that? Obviously, our jobs are differently, but there's, work differently, but there's some similarities in the desire to sort of get past the standard, cardboard cutout of what we want you to cover.
Yeah, I think that, first off, there's an enormous amount of similarities. We're doing the same thing. So it takes time. You get to know the staff around White House and on the Hill. People, I was always pretty modest in my approach to everything because I'm hiding behind a machine, which was an asset. Obviously, working at the New York Times gets your phone calls returned. But I think I built up a reputation that you couldn't get one past me. And so I think that many of the people I dealt with respected my approach. And that worked. And so I put in requests for access or whatever. And they knew that I knew they weren't going to like every picture that I made. They would hate one. I always felt if they hated one, loved one, and thought the other 8 out of 10 was fair, then I succeeded at what I'd done. But, they have to respect Lori Walsh, and I'm sure they do, and because they need you more than you need them, right? and the public, the listening public, needs Lori Walsh more than they, just as much as they need good leadership. So.
And this is, something else I was wondering as I was reading, some of the interviews you've done in the past. On this program, we always talk about what's the conversation that moves, what's the interview that moves the conversation forward. And you're interested in this notion of creating a narrative, photos that create a narrative. How do they fit into the bigger conversation? Tell me a little bit about that, please.
Well, my goal was always to produce a photograph that a reporter wished they were there to write about. So I liked that challenge. And hopefully that photo was visually produced in a way like a well-turned phrase and that it was as effective as a headline. Because I want to draw readers to good reporting. And the New York Times has some excellent reporters that I had the privilege to work with. So I think that was my goal. And then sometimes it's just a holiday and they need something to fill the newspaper. And that's when you're working on some sort of creative essay. And if it ties into what you're doing into politics, then they want to go home early and you get a little space in the paper. So I always have that.
Tell me a little bit about some of the projects that sort of stand out in your career. I'm thinking of the Voices of Afghanistan project. Others that stand out to you, either because they were award-winning or because they had meaning to you beyond an award.
Well, I think Voices of Afghanistan, I went into Afghanistan, I went to Pakistan in October of 2001. I was with Tim Weiner, absolutely brilliant reporter. And before then, I'd mostly been to countries that had gift shops. And when we finally got into Jalalabad, Afghanistan, it was the middle of the night. The next morning, I noticed all these box cameras. There was 5 of them on the roof of a building. And so we always do these man in the street voices, we called them. It used to be the Inquiring Photographer interviews. And so I rented one of those cameras. It's paper negatives, and it's 150-year-old technology. It's from the earliest days of photography when they didn't even have film. They did have film, but it was plates and that, but they would use paper negatives, calotypes. And I thought that really said more about where Afghanistan was at that moment. And it was pretty effective, and I reversed it in Photoshop, photographed it with my camera, reversed in Photoshop, and satellite phoned it back to New York, and they ran a page of it with really dramatic copy that Tim Weiner collected. Beyond that, I really, 2012, I took a different approach to covering the campaign, and I was flipping back and forth between Obama and Romney, and I produced this Smoke-Filled Room series, and it was a graphic novella. I kind of took that Batman comic book approach, and I've always been enamored with old type and that. And so I produced 9 chapters of the campaign, told. And I never knew what the next chapter was going to be. It was developing at the when I started it. Romney hadn't nailed down the nomination yet. But I thought, you know, we need to experiment with different ways to tell stories. And I was pretty happy with that.
Hmm. Are you looking at the other work that's out there and being inspired by it? Are you, you know, closing that off and just looking at, you know, a scene that unfolds in front of you? Are you thinking about, you know, what's innovative right now? Following your curiosity? Like, how do you get to that sort of next level of doing your job that breaks you out of the ordinary and into new territory?
Yeah, many sleepless nights of self-doubt is what drives you, and deadlines, an enormous amount of responsibility, because particularly now, all media, NPR has an incredible photo department. They produce terrific visual work. And at the New York Times, nothing could go out without some sort of a visual, whether it was a graphic, a video, or a photograph. So, and, you know, you need to capture people's eyes. So that's always a great challenge. And again, New York Times was very supportive of new ideas and new approaches. Mm. It's a great time to be in this business. And it's always important. But, boy, we need journalism more than ever right now. And in every form we can come up with. So sometimes you start with the germ of an idea and it doesn't work out. And you slowly develop it, whether it's a single picture or an entire essay. And as I told the students yesterday at the high school here, that I've kept a notebook of, I'd see a shadow on a wall at 10 a.m. in October, and I'd start to build compositions. And then I'd wait, just make my rounds and go back and wait for something to happen within that composition that might be a little bit of journalism or an everyday life picture or a feature.
Mm. So what do you open up your notebook for us? What sort of notes would you take?
I mean, literally, I'd sketch out, like I'm working with photography presented as animation, so I'll sketch out ideas so that when you walk into a room, you can kind of work with those. I mean, there was one I did. It was a series of Democratic candidates at a function where they all had, you know, 2 minutes at the microphone, and I positioned myself on the side of the table. And the animation of the picture was as everybody at the head table stood to rise and gave a applause.
Right.
And the only thing changing in the middle was the candidate. So I like working with that. It's sort of this, is it a Trump loy? I'm trying to sound sophisticated here, but I'm not sure. But anyway, I like working with stuff like that. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So.
Yeah. All right. So what's next for you?
What's next? I'm working with Louis Palou, who's this incredible photographer who's been he's an absolutely sensational photographer and a terrific editor. He's helping me put together a book, a documentary on political photography over the last 25 years in Washington. Well, it'll go back further than that, but that's coming along nicely. And I'm working on a project loosely called, you know, American Meltdown or The Two Americas, and I'm trying to explore this two Americas that seem to be emerging, right? I mean, so we'll see how that looks visually. And this is a great opportunity to be in beautiful South Dakota. I'm hoping I can go home with a picture for that project.
Oh, nice. All right. So tonight at 6:30 at Macquarie Gardens in Brookings, we just have about a minute left. Give us an overview of sort of what, you know, people can expect tonight at the program.
I have a portfolio of starting back in 1972, and I'll talk about how I got into the business and talk about my brothers and show a little work. Take as many questions as people want to ask, and if they don't ask questions, I have a folder with about 1,000 pictures I'll force them to look at.
So. I love it. Stephen Crowley, it's held in the Grand Hall. It begins at 6:30 p.m., and then right after the presentation, you can stay and meet the photographer and have a wine and dessert reception, and that reception concludes at 9 p.m. Tickets were $12 in advance, but now they're available at the door for $15. Any favorite photos that sort of, you know, it's kind of a lame question, but people are going to ask that. Do you have some that stand out that you're so grateful that you sort of caught?
I have two. Do you have time for here for two?
One of them's a parking meter picture.
Okay, one of them's a parking meter picture. I call it Eyes Waiting. It's on the promo. Yeah. The other one is not on the promo. It shows a bank of television monitors, and Bill Clinton is looking into the camera. He's right before he apologizes to the nation and he says, "How's my hair?" And since we weren't allowed in to make that picture, the New York Times ran that. I'm very proud of that picture.
He's standing there fixing his hair right before those.
And asking, "How's my hair?" Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. What did that tell you
about?
Yeah. At that moment.
Well, times have changed, haven't they? You know, I'm sorry we don't have time to talk about Joe Biden.
Stephen, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Laura. I really enjoyed talking with you.
All right.
So hope to see everybody tonight.